Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing, and on this edition, the huge tanker on fire in the Red Sea has begun to leak oil, the US says. What can be done to contain the spill? Also, US consumer confidence reaches a six-month high. Why is Estonia considering renting out its jail cells? And we look at the complications and challenges of keeping older people in the workforce in India. But let's start with the Red Sea, and there have been reports in the past few hours that a Greek-flagged vessel in the Red Sea that was attacked by Houthi rebels last week is still on fire and is now leaking oil. The US said attempts have been made to try and salvage the boat, but that the Houthis were threatening to attack. The ship is carrying over 150,000 tons of crude oil, posing an environmental hazard. The Pentagon spokesperson is Air Force Major General Patrick Ryder.
The MV Delta Sounion now sits immobilized in the Red Sea, where it is currently on fire and appears to be leaking oil, presenting both a navigational hazard and a potential environmental catastrophe. Although the Houthis have claimed that they're conducting these attacks in support of the Palestinian people, their actions prove to the contrary. In fact, these are simply reckless acts of terrorism, which continue to destabilize global and regional commerce, put the lives of innocent civilian mariners at risk, and imperil the vibrant maritime ecosystem in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, the Houthis' own backyard.
Patrick Ryder. Well, joining me now is Chris Reddy, senior scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, which is based in Massachusetts. Chris, thanks for being with us. What's your sense of how risky this is and what the situation is for this vessel, the Sounion?
Yeah, well, the tanker is carrying about 40 million gallons of crude oil, which is significant, but doesn't necessarily mean absolute terrible news in terms of global catastrophes. I think the first thing we want to think about is how do you set up a command station or areas where you can control this fire and safely control the oil leaking? I mean, this is the biggest challenge, is how do you fight back this fire and the leaking oil, and from where, and to do it safely?
Because at the moment, people, we've heard that tugs attempting to get close to it have been attacked. We know that a European naval vessel, in fact, took the crew off a little while ago. Is there some military force in the area that could actually make safeguard this in some way?
I can't speak to those types of operations, but what I can tell you is that the technology is available and the knowledge is available to handle this unfortunate event. It's just really a question of whether or not the logistics and infrastructure are around to do this in a safe manner.
Because it's a time factor, I guess. If oil is leaking now, we don't know how much oil has leaked, and there's an awful lot of oil in this particular tanker. If no one does anything, then that disaster, which the Pentagon was speaking about, will happen.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. I mean, the Red Sea and the ocean are quite resilient, but nevertheless, we do not want to have any more uncontrolled releases of oil than we have to. But you're right. I mean, we have weather, we have tides, we have currents, we have a whole range of other factors that are in play, which just heightens the uncertainty. But I would be really cautious before using statements that are so globally catastrophic. We just got to sit back and watch and see how things evolve.
Okay. And where the boat actually is, it's in an area which, I mean, in terms of tides and these kind of things, does it mean that if there is oil coming out, it's going to spread quite widely?
Well, I can't speak to how wide it is because we don't really know what type of crude oil it is. You know, crude oil comes in a lot of different flavors and characteristics. Sometimes it's thin, sometimes it can be thick. But I do think that the fact that it's so close to a lot of land presents a challenge in terms of preventing oil from reaching, from hitting land, where often you can have some unfortunate events. So we don't have the elbow room, for lack of a better word, for this oil to spread out and get diluted. It's so close to so many country shores.
Well, Chris, and just briefly, you said, you know, in a way you've got to sit back and see what happens, but how long have we got before this does become that much worse disaster that we were mentioning?
I can't speak to the integrity of the ship and what's being happening to it right now. So I really can't speak to it. But what I do think is wishing everybody the best of luck to handle this unfortunate event.
Well, I hope there's a bit more than luck involved in it. But Chris, thanks so much for being with us. That's Chris Reddy of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Now, it's often said that among the most important things in the global economy is the confidence of the US consumer. The willingness of Americans to go out and spend moves commerce and enterprise right across the planet. And on that basis, we all have reason to be, well, a bit optimistic. US consumer confidence rose to 6-month high in August amid optimism over the economic outlook, although there have been concerns about the jobs market. And this all comes from the Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Index. And I'm very pleased to say Dana Peterson, Chief Economist and leader of the Economy Strategy and Finance Center at the Conference Board, joins me on the line now. Dana, thanks for being with us. Just take us through what you found in terms of what consumer confidence is there.
Absolutely. Consumer confidence has ticked up over the last couple of months. But when we look at it over the last 2 or 3 years, it's basically been moving sideways. It hasn't broken up to the upside or to the downside. So we like to look at the details. And certainly consumers were a little bit more optimistic on the business outlook and also their incomes, but they have been expressing a little bit more concern about not only the current employment situation, but also the employment situation going forward.
So questions about whether they would have a job, obviously informing whether or not they're going to spend their money.
Absolutely. So the number saying that jobs are hard to get has ticked up a little bit, and the percent saying that jobs are easy to get has ticked down. But on net, it's still positive. So most consumers are working if they want to, and they are receiving that income, which is so important for consumption.
So how is it phrased then? You sort of ask them, are they feeling better than they felt before? Is there that kind of thing?
I think it's still mixed. Consumers definitely, on the whole, are saying the labor market is okay, I'm working, but they're still complaining a lot about prices, and not the rate of increase in prices, but the level. They're saying bread is $10, eggs are $12, and that's really upsetting them. And also, consumers seem to react to what we saw in financial markets in early August, where you had a big 2-day sell-off in stock markets.
And also, of course, I mean, just looking at some of the detail of this, your expectations index is very interesting. The numbers, I think they went up to 82.5 from 81.1. And generally, the feeling is anything below 80 signals a recession ahead. So, I mean, economists, we're saying, well, thank God, it looks like we're not in that position.
Yes, unfortunately, this measure has been moving back and forth over that 80 line. So that's why we do ask consumers point blank, do you expect a recession is going to happen at some point over the next year? And so far, very few are indicating that they think a recession is ahead. So even though that expectations number has been moving around 80, the explicit question says that they're not really looking for something horrible to happen over the next year.
And going in what's going on with the labor market, because that's potentially, I suppose, what's horrible if you lose your job. Share of consumers who view jobs as being plentiful slipped a bit. So that's interesting term, plentiful. I mean, what does that reflect, do you think?
Well, I think if you're going out to look for a job, that there are lots of options for you. So yes, it has been slipping a bit. And we're not really surprised by that. Certainly when you look at the payrolls numbers and all the news you're hearing about the labor market, that it's cooling. Many people think, well, wow, that means that I might lose my job. But really, we're cooling from a very robust pace of gains after the pandemic when businesses were trying to replenish their payrolls. We've more or less done that. So the gains that you're going to see from month to month can be smaller. But the unemployment rate has ticked up. We think that there's some special factors there. But nonetheless, when you know the unemployment rate was 3.4% last year, now it's 4.3%, that does scare a lot of people. And they're not economists who will look back and say, well, this is super low. All they know is what they're hearing on the news.
And are you looking at people, I suppose, who are talking also about inflation and how people view inflation, their inflation expectations at the moment? I mean, they've been through a rough patch, heaven knows, but the feeling is that at the moment there's greater confidence in that.
Absolutely. 1 year inflation expectations among consumers have fallen back to where they were in May of 2020. Now, that was shortly after the pandemic started in the U.S. So that's pretty low. We're not all the way back to where we were back in 2019, but certainly consumers are noticing that price or inflation are not rising as quickly. But again, they still are writing in and saying things are very expensive. But the good news is that they do expect that interest rates are going to start falling at some point over the next 12 months.
Well, let's pick up on that. Dana, thank you very much for being with us. Dana Peterson there of the Conference Board. Let's ask about how it all does play into the wider outlook for the U.S. Joining me is Mervyn Jabaraj, who's director and for the Center for Business and Economic Research at the University of Arkansas. Mervyn, thank you for being with us. Is there a sense that this kind of consumer confidence is actually going to play quite a lot into the decisions of the Fed when it comes to interest rates?
I think what we've seen with the new consumer confidence report is broadly in line with what we've seen consumers saying and doing over the past few months. So if this new report had indicated consumers are a lot more pessimistic about the economy, then I think we would be a little more concerned about the pace and the magnitude of the rate cuts from the Federal Reserve. But broadly, we're seeing consumers respond to economic news in the way that we would have expected. And so this consumer confidence being up slightly, even though it's still at a fairly low range compared to before the most recent recession, doesn't quite change the calculus for what the Federal Reserve is likely to do in September.
Okay, so I mean this idea of a 25-point basis point cut looks like the most likely thing as we sit at this moment?
I think the economic data coming later this week with new payroll data, unemployment rate data, and then PCE, which is personal consumption expenditures that the Federal Reserve follows closely, and CPI also coming later this week is probably more likely to determine sort of the magnitude of the rate cut. Less so, I think, when the rate cut might happen.
Right. So it could be potentially. I mean, some people even talked about 50 basis points, and others have said, well, maybe nothing at all if the data is really bad. Is that still a swing area, as it were?
Well, I think the 50 basis point is probably very unlikely unless, unexpectedly the labor market is a lot softer than we are expecting to see when the report comes out later this week. Or that inflation has dropped dramatically, which neither one is really expected. But the flip side is I don't expect them to stay neutral either. I think there is some consensus that the labor market has cooled more rapidly than the Federal Reserve thought it did over the last 12 months with the revisions that we've gotten from the BLS. So I think they've been on track to cut. They're very likely to go with 0.25% in September.
And very briefly, in the end, it is that balance as ever between inflation and the labor market, which is really at the crux of all this. And that's where we need to look.
Exactly. And I think, between even the last Federal Reserve meeting and Jay Powell's comments at Jackson Hole recently, I think the balance of their concern has now shifted from inflation back to the labor market.
All right. Thanks so much for being with us there. Mervyn Jabaraj there, Director of the Center for Business Economic Research at the University of Arkansas. So how is all this playing on the markets? Joining me is Ayako Yoshoka, Senior Portfolio Manager at Wealth Enhancement Group in L.A. Ayako, thanks for being with us again. What do you make out of that consumer confidence data? Because it was up and it was good, but it's not huge, as Mervyn was saying there. What does it tell us?
Sure. So I think, in general, the number kind of gives us what we've already known about the consumer. The consumer spending is moderating and the consumer is being very discerning about what they're spending their money on. But in general, the job market is still relatively strong. And so that keeps things sort of flowing in the long term.
And of course, we have got some more data coming up. The July personal consumption expenditure data, of course, and a bit of inflation data. It's very interesting that how all this is going to be playing. I mean, a lot of head scratching going on at the Fed, I guess.
Sure. But I think, you know, in general, you know, the Fed's preferred measure, this PCE index, is likely to come in around 2.5, 2.6%. And that sort of continues to give the Fed confidence that inflation is on its trend back towards their 2% target.
Now, Janka, let's talk about what has been a really big name on the markets, of course, in recent months, NVIDIA. Their quarterly report comes out on Wednesday. They're the chip giants, really, in US terms and in global terms, really. And they have really pushed up everything in a very recent and very fast way. What's the expectation of what's going to happen on Wednesday? What are we going to hear? Are we going to be disappointed?
You know, AI has been, you know, the theme of 2024, and NVIDIA has really been at the forefront of all of it. And so, you know, expectations are very high going into tomorrow's earnings report. But, you know, for the most part, NVIDIA has come through in many of these quarters. We'll just have to see if they come through again and increase their revenue guidance for the next quarter.
And briefly, in fact, of course, the expectation did lift all other sort of tech stocks today, didn't they?
Absolutely. I think, you know, in general, the semiconductor index has been, you know, a little bit volatile as we go into earnings. It was down on Monday and it's recovered a little bit today. But the big move will likely be on Thursday after we get the report from NVIDIA on Wednesday.
Ayako, thanks for that. Ayako Yoshoka there speaking to me from LA. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave. Forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
Service. Now, what's the latest thing that Estonia wants to export? Textiles? Machinery? No. Prison cells, or at least they want to rent them out to countries that don't have enough. Estonia's Justice Minister, Liisa Pakosta, says her country doesn't need the prison space that they have. And if she can persuade the rest of her government to back her plan, it could raise around 30 million euros a year by renting out the prisons. I spoke to her and asked her to explain the idea.
In Estonia, we have a very specific situation where we have half more prison places than we need today. And it is going back to 1990s, after we regained our independence, the rate of criminality was quite high. So we literally put the criminals to the prison. It improved the situation quite quickly. And now we are in the situation that we have new, wonderful, very secure, modern prisons, but only half of the place is filled. So the obvious solution for that would be that we raise our export.
Well, how would you do this? Would you work within the EU or wider than the EU?
Of course, prisons include very much also various security issues. So we would look toward NATO countries, our good companions, and discuss what would be the best secure solution for both of the countries. The challenge is, of course, the first priority is that the situation in Estonia wouldn't be worse. So it means, for example, that everybody who comes to our prison does not have a permission to go to a weekend to the city, for example. Or when the prison time is up to the end, the prisoners will return to the original country.
But the money that you would charge the countries with, what would you say? Someone was going in, I don't know, for a five-year sentence. How much would the country have to pay to get one of your cells?
It's up to the agreement, of course. But there is a practice of renting out cells in European Union or in Europe already. So there is some idea of how much it could be. But, of course, the final details would be with very many specific arguments involved. So our first priority is to keep our people working.
I heard one report that perhaps at least 30 million euros a year could be raised through this. So presumably you've got an idea of the kind of costs and benefits that you would get.
Absolutely. So our cost for existing prisoners is well known to us. And if we add to this all the specific tasks that have to be fulfilled when we have prisoners from other countries, it needs also some translation costs, some special social services costs, etc. So that's the base. So of course, it's no reason to do this without earning a little bit money also.
Indeed, but I suppose, you know, if I were a taxpayer in Estonia, I might say, well, why don't you just knock these extra prison places down and build houses for us, and build schools and build hospitals?
And that is why we need the export money. So that is why to build the schools and hospitals, we need actually investments to Estonia. Renting out these places is one of the possibilities to get the money. And when we are now looking to the statistics in Europe or in the wider region, we actually see that the criminality rates are raising. They are raising in most of the countries. And we assume that that would hit Estonia as well. So it might be that we need these places ourselves in, like, say, 7 years, because all our prisons are very modern, very new ones. So it's no reason to knock them down.
But by then, they might be full, I don't know, of French criminals or British criminals or Italian criminals, and you might have to throw them out.
We will keep them locked in very clearly. So as said, we have very modern prisons, very secure, very well-trained personnel. So that would mean that in coming years, our personnel will be even more trained, even more professional, with practicing with prisoners from other countries. Isn't that great?
But some people say it's just a bit odd, isn't it, to become a kind of, to sell prison space in a country. It's a very odd way of behaving as a country.
I would say that if we take Estonia, a country with one of the world's best judicial correction systems that has corrected the need for our own prison, we have very low rate of people returning to prisons. We have very low rate people that we have to send to prisons. That would be a very good promotion for Estonia. And if we do something really well, we can help other countries as well.
So, Minister, is this going to happen? Has he got government approval?
I'm looking for government approval. So the government meeting has not taken place discussing this. So it might be that our government as a team decides a little bit of the other way.
But you're hoping to persuade them?
I hope to persuade them, because when I'm looking to people, working places, the professionalism that we can offer and really the high standards that we want to keep, then actually that would be a great solution. Sorry to say.
Minister, thank you very much for speaking. I really appreciate your time and really appreciate you being willing to speak to us.
Thank you so much, and everybody is welcome to Estonia, a very secure country.
In your prisons or outside?
Outside the prisons, but also inside the prisons, actually, yes.
Well, we'll see what happens with that. That was the Estonian Justice Minister, Liisa Pakosta. Now, it wasn't too long ago that China was the most populous country on Earth, but it's been overtaken now by India, which is fast heading towards a population of 1.5 billion. That population's aging rapidly. It's estimated the number of people over the age of 60 in India will double by the year 2050. An aging population does bring challenges, of course, but also opportunities. Some companies in India are hoping to cash in on the booming silver economy, as the BBC's Arunadeer Mukherjee reports.
In their 60s and on the road, this group of over a dozen old couples have travelled more than 1,000 kilometres away from their home in Maharashtra in western India, with one aim: checking things off their bucket lists. Travelling on a specially curated tour for senior citizens, the couples are visiting the city of Jaipur. Moving at a comfortable pace, stopping for photographs, taking in the sights and sounds of the city. For many, like Prakash and Preeti Parshikar, this is the first time they've had the chance to go on a trip like this.
We spent our entire lives working, caring for our children, giving them the best. We didn't have time to travel.
We also didn't have the money to do it as well before. I felt we haven't seen most of India. So why not do it now?
It's this sentiment that travel companies like Veena World felt would be a lucrative market to tap into. The company's founder, Sunila Patil, says this is a market segment that is time-rich and cash-rich.
They don't have to wait for a vacation to travel at any point. Like when you think of the younger age group or the families, the first thing happens is when school starts is you take the children's calendar and then you mark out when is it that you can travel. A senior citizen's age group is such that you name it and they can travel.
6 nights and 7 days ke liye rehta hai.
It's what Startup Senior World has also been trying to do. Rahul Gupta started the company 10 years ago, focusing primarily on helping senior citizens travel. Its initial success has now made them foray into other verticals, like making and selling special mobile phones for seniors, devices that can be remote operated by their children from anywhere around the world. Rahul also shows me an app his team has developed, helping the elderly connect with each other, find common hobbies, and join communities. Rahul tells me why he's betting big on this segment.
It has now come to a stage where, you know, it's getting attractive. The size is big. There are micro markets emerging which are monetizable. And it creates a huge opportunity. It is a blue ocean. Virtually nobody is focused on the segment, especially in a country like India where there are far more youngsters. It's easier to target. So we think it makes for a compelling business opportunity, both from a social standpoint in terms of impact, as well as from a financial standpoint going forward.
But not everyone can afford the services of companies like Veena World or Senior World. In most Indian cities and towns, you'll also see the more disadvantaged elderly population. According to the UN, 40% of the elderly in India fall among the poorest of the poor, while one-fifth have no income at all. While the government has some policies that give subsidized healthcare and aid to the elderly, welfare services for them are still largely relegated to the private sector and hence not free. And many in this travelling group acknowledge that privilege. And as this batch of seniors dances to Bollywood hits at the end of their tour, can India keep pace with the needs of its ageing population?
Arunaday Mukherjee there, and this subject, ageing populations, how to deal with them, is all this week on the programme.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.